We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. The Asian carp is a fish that has a very healthy appetite and they can grow quite large. And one of them can eat several times its body weight in a day. These are fish that were originally brought into the country for the purpose of fish farming, and they were in the south, but they escaped into the Mississippi. Some people seem to think this was during the floods of the 1990s. Since that time, these fish have been moving north, and wildlife managers are very worried that they may end up in Lake Michigan. In this first hour of Focus 580 today, we'll try to talk, generally speaking, a little bit about the health of the Great Lakes, and certainly non-native invasive species are one issue for the Great Lakes, and this gives us a good case study, the case of the Asian carp, something we can talk about specifically, but we also do want to talk maybe in a little bit more general kinds of terms about the health of the lake, something that we try to do from time to time here on the show. And for that purpose, we have two guests with us. Here in the studio with me, John Epifanio. He is a molecular ecologist with the Illinois State Natural History Survey, here based on the campus of the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. He's also a research coordinator with Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. And joining us by telephone is Patrice Charlebois. She is an aquatic invasives specialist with Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people who are calling in just to try to be as brief as they can, and we just ask that so we can get as many callers in as possible. But again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, here in the studio, Dr. Epifanio, thanks very much.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
And joining us on the telephone, Ms. Charlebois. Hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here on the program as well.
Welcome.
Just maybe one thing I should do here at the beginning is ask one or the other of you, maybe I'll ask Patrice, just to tell us, what is Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant?
Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant is one of about 30 programs throughout the United States and Puerto Rico that receives federal funding from the Department of Commerce through NOAA, and we use that funding to fund, fund research on coastal issues and then also to do outreach on these same types of issues.
Okay, so we're talking about the ocean coasts, but we're also talking about the coasts of the Great Lakes.
Right, and we also, here in the Great Lakes, we also deal with inland waters too, like the rivers and the inland lakes. And I should say that all of these programs are based at generally in the land grant institutions.
Okay, like this one.
Yeah.
Like this one. Okay. Then another kind of general question, maybe here I'll turn to John Epifanio. You know, as I said, periodically here on the program, we like to talk about the Great Lakes, talk about water issues, and we think that that's just a good thing every once in a while to sort of check in and talk about. And at the same time, though, occasionally I guess I have had this reaction from some people when they heard that we were going to talk about the Great Lakes. They sort of said, Great Lakes, we're here in central Illinois. Well, what's the Great Lakes to us? You know, who cares? And I thought, you know, that might not make such a bad thing to talk about. Why should, for people like us here in East Central Illinois, why should the Great Lakes matter?
Well, I think this is a particularly interesting time that we're in right now, dealing with the Great Lakes, in that there's a relatively monumental effort that's just begun under the current administration to restore Great Lakes health. So there's a large initiative that has really – the funding for this has really culminated a five-year effort to focus on restoring biological, chemical, physical, and other attributes of the lakes itself. One of the the reasons why the lakes, I think, are important to us. One is, in North America, it is the source or the site of a very large proportion of our surface freshwater. Mm-hmm. We don't get our water from them, but they do exert an incredible influence on our hydrological systems here in North America, as well as our weather patterns. We often talk about, when I was growing up in the suburbs of Chicago, we talked about lake effect snow, which was our that we dealt with. And so that demonstrates the influence we have. The other thing that I think is important for us to remember is that the watershed that the Great Lakes occupy is immense. It's not just the lakes themselves, but there are feeder watershed. The watershed itself has feeder rivers and streams that go into it. And in essence, the Great Lakes is a large river. It's not a stagnant set of bathtubs. Hmm. This water moves. And so anything that goes on in Chicago, Milwaukee, Cleveland, et cetera, affects everything downstream. And Cleveland is downstream of Chicago. We, in turn, are downstream from places up above in the headwaters that we have, which eventually ends up in the watershed we occupy here in Champaign and Urbana, down in the Gulf. So we're all interconnected to these things. And so it's important to think not just what our zip code that we're located in, but what the influences and impacts of any actions and activities that go on.
Yeah. That sounds like that's a pretty good answer to the question. I don't know if Patrice Charlotte Boy, you would like to add anything to that.
Not really. I would just emphasize that with the connection of Lake Michigan with the Illinois River, that it does, you know, it does indeed, as John was explaining, it does indeed connect the Great Lakes to the lower central part of Illinois, as well as the Mississippi Basin.
Well, let me ask you, if I asked in a very general way, for you to talk a little bit about the health of the Great Lakes at this point in time, what would you say?
I would say that it is in trouble, and it's a continuing trouble, I guess. You know, we had a lot of pollution back in the 50s and 60s, and that definitely has gotten much better over time. But biologically, I would say that we're in trouble. The introduction of the zebra mussel, I think, was one of the turning points. We had some before that too, but that's where we really see the lake. Changing to a more oligotrophic system, meaning that it's not producing as much food as it has in the past. And so the fish are having trouble finding enough to eat. The zebra mussel populations are increasing. The quagga mussel, which is a relative of the zebra mussel, is now very dominant on the bottom of the lake, and it's moved into the deeper waters. So it's pulling food away from even those fishes that we thought were immune to this food deprivation, but pulling it out from deeper waters and affecting the reproductive capabilities and the growth capabilities of these fishes.
Mm-hmm. And here, in a bit, maybe we'll talk about the carp, but I just want to come back to connect to that just for a second, because I talked in my introduction about how much they eat, and I guess I want to make sure that people understand the concern here is not that the carp are going to go eat other fish, but that what they're doing is that they're soaking up a lot of the general food supply that then other fish would eat.
Exactly. The Asian carp, which we usually are referring to the big head and the silver carp when we use that term, they are both filter feeders. So they are consuming the phytoplankton and the zooplankton, which form the base of the food chain. So it's the tiny plants and the tiny animals that live in the aquatic systems. So they would be filtering those out. This is it's the base of the food chain. So if you remove that, then the upper levels are going to be affected, obviously. And it's also that the same types of organisms that the zebra and the quagga mussels have been impacting. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a double whammy on the rest of the fishes in the ecosystem, yeah, as well as the other types of organisms other than fish, which are also important.
Well, I'll turn back here to John Epifanio. And, you know, one of the things that I was taking a look at here was a report on the health of the Great Lakes for 2009, and it's a report that's for a number of years now. It's come out every year, and I believe that the EPA was involved in this report, and it's the kind of thing that people can look at online if they're interested. And I guess one of the things that I was really struck by here is there is a graph that shows the rise in aquatic non-native species in the Great Lakes over time. And it's very dramatic if you take, and it goes from the 1840s essentially up to the present, up to the 2000s. And there has been a very steady increase over those years, and it's really shot way up from like essentially nothing in the 1840s to the number of aquatic non-native species now looks like maybe about 180. It's starting to approach 200. And so that makes me wonder, well, what are the major causes for this big increase in non-native species in the lakes?
Right. That's a great question because there are a couple things going on, first of all. One, historically, much of the focus of this accounting has been focused on fish species. Mm-hmm. We've paid attention to them. They tend to be the kind of the poster children of this invasion events. And it started with alewife and smelt and sea lamprey and some of the others that Pat mentioned. And so we're starting to pay attention more to other species as well. So the quagga mussels and spiny water fleas and other little microscopic kinds of things. So we're paying attention at a different level. But more importantly, as historically some of these things were introduced by building of canals and waterways, such as the Chicago Waterway, such as the Welland Canal that connected Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. We had the Erie Canal, which connected the Hudson River Basin to the Great Lakes Basin. So we had a number of these connections that were made that historically and geologically separated mm-hmm. these lakes. So now we had entryways. Since then, through industry such as shipping, which was, we think, is responsible for the introduction of the zebra and quagga mussels, came in the ballast water of ocean-going vessels that also enter in the Great Lakes as they exchanged their ballast water, released propagules, babies, and the mussels themselves, and they became established. So those are methods. Recreational boating potentially is one avenue that we can have as we trailer boats from one watershed to another. We've got pet industries, potentially the aquaculture industry, and several other kinds of things like that. They we call them vectors for introduction. So some of these vectors are now more acute for some of these organisms, and certain components of the aquatic communities are more amenable to different components or different kinds of vectors. So we have all these things conspiring all at one time, and the introductions of these things have been a relatively accumulative effect. Many of these introductions fail miserably. And historically, when water quality in the Great Lakes was so bad, things couldn't actually get established very well. However, as we've managed since the Clean Water Act to clean up the watersheds, at least chemically clean them up a little bit more, although there are still pockets and dead zones and things, the opportunities for these things to get a foothold has increased as well.
Mm. Let me just introduce again the two guests we have here this morning in this first hour of Focus 580. John Epifanio is a molecular ecologist with the Illinois State Natural History Survey, which is based here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's also a research coordinator with Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. Patrice Charlebois is an aquatic invasives specialist with Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. And as she explained, this is a federally funded research project. There are a number of centers. Many of them are based at land-grant universities like this one, and they're interested in coastal health, including the ocean coasts of the nation, but also the health of the coast around the Great Lakes and also inland waterways, and then do a lot of research on the kind of issues that we're talking about here this morning. And what we thought we'd do is to try to talk a little bit in a general way about the health of the Great Lakes, but very specifically, one of the big problems is the presence of non-native species. And here in a moment, we'll go on and talk about the one that's in the news a lot right at the moment. That is the Asian carp. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk specifically about the Asian carp. Patrice Charlebois, where did this fish come from?
Well, it's native to China and parts of Vietnam, and it inhabits the large river systems in those countries. And again, it was brought over, some scientists or researchers brought it in to do research on it, and then it was imported by the aquaculture industry, as you indicated earlier, to work in their ponds to help clean them up, to help keep the algae down in these ponds. And again, we think that they most likely got out into the Mississippi River during the floods in the 90s. But they are native to, obviously, as their name indicates, to parts of Asia.
Mm. So, and these fish, I think I read something, a quote from you saying that one of the ways that we can get at this problem is to encourage people to catch them and eat them. And you say, I think I remember seeing a quote from you saying, actually, they're pretty good, but it sounds as if initially they weren't, that wasn't the idea when they were brought in, that they would be raised for food?
Right. The food was very much a secondary issue for them. They really just wanted to be able to clean up those ponds. And, yeah. You know, they taste great. They can be made in myriad ways. They can be deep fried, made. There's one gentleman from USGS. I know one of his favorite dishes is a Thai dish he makes with them. But they have a really mild flavor, a lot like cod. And there's an issue with they're bony in that they have small Y bones, kind of like people are familiar with, like in pike and that. But we do have, actually on our website, we have videos that show you how you can cut around these bones and make it so that you can have some boneless pieces. Mm. And I want to say that I would encourage people to catch them, one, because you'd be doing a good thing, and that if by reducing the populations, we're decreasing the ecological harm that these can have in our systems. We also are most likely, if we can reduce the downstream populations, then we reduce the threat that they could have to the Great Lakes in terms of that if they are not crowded downstream, then they're less likely to move upstream to uncrowded areas.
Mm, okay. Did you want to add anything?
Well, yeah. The important part about these things and the interesting part about them, and they are absolutely fabulous when you smoke them or grill them, what have you. They're an incredibly efficient at converting waterborne biomass food items into protein. And that, even though that wasn't the original idea, when the aquaculture industry, I believe, recognized how efficient they became, some very clever people said, wait a second, this can be a marketable food source. And so there was a period of hype that went along with the conversion of these things and just their scientific interest into the aquaculture universe, very similar to some of the rhetorical hype when the European carps were introduced in the late 1800s, 1880s. Very interesting dissertation here by a student in the urban and regional planning program examined that. And it's astounding to me when I was reading that dissertation by Glenn Sandiford that the same words, relatively speaking, were used almost 100 years later for a different set of species. It's the same kind of hype that this was going to be the answer. It was almost a free lunch, so to speak. And in ecology, very rarely is there a free lunch.
No such thing. Okay. Let's talk with a caller. We have someone on a cell phone here, line number one, I think, calling from Paxton. Line one. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I grew up on the Illinois River up at Oglesby and La Salle in Peru, and I remember when I was a kid, the Illinois River was almost proof of the New Testament because we believed that people could walk on water. You just walk across it. And now, with this Asian carp thing, I'm glad that you have been discussing what the point was that I wanted to get to, which is, isn't this potentially a boon? I mean, I would think that the pet food industry would be interested in any kind of a fish that jumps into your boat and volunteers to become eaten. And the last comment that you made about the hype puts to mind in my age range, you people are all too young to remember that there was ever a cartoonist named Al Capp who drew Little Abner, but he was a marvelous satirist. He, right after World War II, when the Marshall Plan and a lot of utopian thinking was taking place, invented in his comic strip a little critter called the Shmoo. And it looked like a bowling pin, except that it would volunteer to do whatever you wanted it to do. It would turn itself into a beefsteak or three dozen eggs or anything you wanted. The thing would do it for you. And, of course, it absolutely ruined the economy, and the big corporations wanted to stamp out all the schmoos. But the idea that these carp could be a modern equivalent to the schmoo just ran through my mind while I was listening to you. Now, last thing, what is the current economic value of these fish? I'm picturing, having seen some of the video of the hundreds of them jumping up in the air, an airboat going down the river with nets about a foot off the surface of the water, trailing another one, making a lot of noise to make them jump, and just harvesting almost like picking corn with a combine. But I'm curious to know what they're going for now and what's the prospect that they're going to become maybe imbued with a better PR agent who, maybe the guy who rescued swine flu and saved the pig industry by calling it H1R1. If you get somebody involved with that, doesn't call them Asian carp, we call them leaping schmooze or I don't know what. But some ideas for you, but I would like to know about the current economics of it.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, you get whoever changed the name of the Patagonian toothfish to the Chilean sea bass. Well, require that guy. Well, what do you think? I'll ask here, John Epifanio. Is there commercial potential here, and how do you balance that with any ecological harm that might result?
Right. First of all, I appreciate the visit to Slobovia, and as a kid, I used to visit there myself. There is an interest in employing a commercial harvest as one component of population reduction. There are a number of commercial fisheries, particularly down in the Alton area, that part of where the Illinois River meets up with the Mississippi. There are fish houses that routinely will buy them, and it's not a particularly expensive fish right now. They're getting somewhere in the range, I'm guessing, 10 to 15 cents a pound. Someone can correct me. My information may be a little dated. There has been an interest also in harvesting for basically to create a surimi-like product. So to take away the fish component of it, process it, basically extrude protein into artificial crab legs. And when you do that, you can flavor it with any way you want. The whole idea, though, would be to support or even subsidize removal for these industries. I'm not an economist, but one of the issues that in my mind has always been a little bit problematic is that business model requires easy access and abundance of the fish themselves. And once you drop them down below a certain point, it no longer it tips the economics of it out of sync that it's not worth going out and harvesting anymore. So there are economists, and I know some of the folks over here in ACE have examine this. I don't have the data fully at my fingertips, but I know they've looked at that and what some of the tipping points might be, and whether this is actually an economic model that could work for as a way to reduce and as a side provide essentially protein.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, Patrice, whether it is would it be if we're going to say that it's not a good idea for these fish to have unconstrained populations in the wild. And if we say that there's some potential for commercial development of the fish, is it actually possible to farm them and keep them contained and make sure that they don't get away from you, as apparently they did?
You know, that's one. That's really one issue that we need to be careful with as we are looking to develop more of the commercial markets, is that if we have all of these businesses and all these people being reliant on this resource, and then we deplete the resource, then, you know, what's going to happen to these people? So we have to be careful of that. And I would caution against us, you know, wanting to develop this as a farm fishery or an aquaculture fishery for just that reason. We could have the escapes again, and we could have them, get into new and different watersheds. And we also, we have to be careful about encouraging this, because individuals might go off and say, oh, well, they're getting money, then I can go, stock them in my backyard pond and make some money too. So these are just all kind of cautions that we have to be aware of as we're thinking about these commercial markets.
Hmm. I have a caller here I want to get to, but just real quick to talk about where we are now with the fish. They've been seen in the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
And now there is a connection between the river and Lake Michigan, the worry is that they could get into the lake. And I think actually DNA from these fish has been found in the lake, although no fish have been found in the lake yet. How far from the lake have fish actually been caught, physically, identified?
My understanding is that the DNA has not been found in the lake.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm misremembering that. I'm happy for the correction.
Well, yeah, someone can correct me if I'm wrong. But my understanding is that the DNA has been found about 8 miles downstream from the lake.
Okay, so that's what they're saying, is that the DNA has been found that close to the lake, and then the fish themselves
have been found about, John, how far downstream is that from Lake Michigan? About 20 miles?
Right, approximately.
Okay. Lockport, yeah.
Right.
So the fish have been sighted about 20 miles down.
Okay.
And, that, but, and that's a confirmed, body in hand.
Yes.
Type.
And one thing, the eDNA, it's probably likely that there are fish in that area. But there's also, and John, correct me if you have more information, but there's also the chance that there was water taken from where these fish were, taken upstream by another method, say like by a barge, and released upstream, and then the eDNA would have been detected. So I think that people are thinking that that's a possibility, but we're not really wanting to think that way, because we want to if there's a possibility of a actual body, that we want to make sure we're looking for that.
Oh, okay. Right. What Pat's referring to here is kind of a risk of a false positive. And there may be, aside from the DNA being sloughed off through cells of the individuals that might be upstream, there may be either through ballast water of the barges. I don't know enough about barge traffic to know whether they, in fact, change their ballast, how much they do that, and those kinds of things. But there are legal fish markets in Chicago whose stormwater outside the fish markets could, in fact, run down into this system. Fish are legal to have as long as they're not transported live. So you can get these apparently in Chicago. So if there's a fish market and this DNA gets washed down a storm drain during cleanup and that kind of thing, that wouldn't go through the sewage treatment plants kinds of things. There may be sources. Birds, in fact, may be able to carry small individuals. We just don't know enough. And so some of these things are hypothetical. And we're working on trying to figure some of those things out. What are the potential sources for false positives to rule them out, so that in the future when we have these positives, we'll have at least high confidence that it's because there's fish there. There's uh-huh. adults there that are alive and swimming around.
So could it be that there are adults there alive and swimming around in the lake and nobody has seen them yet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And the important part about the lot has been made about the one body that they've actually found just above the Lockport lock and dam. Where there's one, there's going to be more. These are not fish that spend their life by and large in solitary confinement. They're a schooling fish. So the fact that there was one and he was about 22 inches long, of a size that indicates that, yeah, there are likely more, even though they weren't confirmed and visually identified. So, the actions that were recently taken, some will argue that, well, maybe it was getting ahead of, driving out in front of our headlights here a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think the the risk assessment that was done, that the state and federal resource managers decided that the risk of doing nothing was a greater chance and letting these guys potentially get through an electric barrier that they have set up when it goes down for maintenance than doing nothing and assuming they didn't, these fish weren't there and this was a false positive kind of thing and risking some actually getting through, potentially having a big impact on the lake system itself.
Okay. Well, let's talk with another caller here, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. I warned the screener that I have a bad pun, which is I heard someone carping about the fish kill. And saying that there was $7 million spent for one fish, and that seems to me that there's also a song one could rewrite, which is dead carp at the bottom of the Sagway instead of dead skunk in the middle of the road. It seems to me the electric barrier is a good idea because there's a lot of other things that, you know, since the river's been turned around and all and everything else has been altered that one needs to worry about. So I don't think just creating a market for carp would eat our way out of the mess is appropriate. It's sort of I just used it as a metaphor for just the whole environmental disruption that's going on in the world. It seems to me it's an appropriate one. And someone earlier was talking about how these fish just invite themselves to die by jumping into your boat. Well, they've actually killed a couple of people, apparently, because they've hit people in the chest and apparently arrested their hearts or something or other. I don't know if they were frail people out fishing for huge carp, but it's a bit surreal, it seems to me. I have an Al Camp critique, too, but I will repress myself on that one. So it just seems to me that this is distasteful to have to kill all these fish like this and poison the area. I guess they decided that after that experience, they're just trying to overfish them in that certain section of and the barriers back up, I guess. So I wanted to interject those several things because it just seems it's easy to just suggest that. Another market solution that we'll just eat our way out of it, and it just seems absurd to me.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the points of the caller, and I guess I wasn't meaning to suggest that would be the best or only kind of way of dealing with the problem. Let's talk about what has been done, and just maybe, John Epifanio, can you just give us the thumbnail sketch of dealing with this problem and how difficult it is, because after all, we're talking about, you know, free-flowing water. How do you set up barriers to keep things from moving around?
Right. This is an incredibly difficult and head scratching kind of events, series of events that have gone on. One of the things we're fortunate enough to have, the state of Illinois has field stations that are basically monitoring stations on the Mississippi River and even up in Zion, Illinois, on Lake Michigan. We have, through the Institute of Natural Resource Sustainability here on campus, which is the overseeing or the overarching umbrella for the Natural History Survey and others, we have these labs. And the important part about that is that those folks are out there 12 months of the year monitoring these water systems. And they're looking at fish, water quality, chemicals, you know, the chemical changes, vegetation, and so on and so on and so on. So very exhaustive biological monitoring. Once these things have been identified and they started tracking these things upward, several years ago when this idea for the electric barrier, which originally was designed to keep gobies from Lake Michigan entering the Mississippi River going downstream, then they realized that in fact, with some modifications, they could probably address the Asian carp as well. Because of the hydrology right there at Romeoville and where the Chicago Waterway and the Des Plaines River almost parallel each other, there's some low-lying areas that, in exceptional flood years, the difference between the two is not exactly stark. So there is some potential movement there. So the electric barrier and the electrical approach is one that's been used for numerous species, numerous other situations, is one potential sort of buffering avenue. Physically netting may be another. They've talked about, you know, deoxygenating the Chicago waterway or some kind of heat shock or using sound and light and other disturbances. One of the things with the silver carp, we think that noise is responsible for them jumping. And so if you can create a noise barrier, that may in fact be an alternative or a redundant way. The difficult part of some of these kinds of things is you've got electricity in water, and then you're this is also a working barging canal. So you have these major pieces of metal that are moving across this electrical field. So there are some engineering issues as well. So you've got all of these things that are kind of complex and interacting all sort of simultaneously, and it's a very difficult situation that these managers are forced to deal with. We do the research side of it. We have the easy job. All we have to do is document, whereas the folks who are managers have to actually do those kinds of things. And people like Pat, who are outreach folks, have helped communicate the need and the reasons why we do these things, what to do, and how to deal with these in the future. So it's a lot of different players contributing here.
Well, let me ask her, is there anything you'd want to add to that?
Another way that we are trying to limit, I guess, the spread of species either around the barrier or just in general, too, is through the outreach that we do. Because another way that these species can move is through humans. Like an individual cleaning out their water garden at the end of the year, you know, and then taking the excess plants and putting them into a natural waterway. So we work to inform people about the risks of doing things like this and some alternatives that they can do to protect the environment, like bait bucket use, you know, to make sure that you don't take your bait bucket from one waterway to another. Or in the case of Asian carp, the juvenile Asian carp look a lot like shad, and so people will often collect their own bait. They could be collecting Asian carp juveniles and then taking them to other waterways. So this is another effort that's been done to try to prevent this movement of organisms across watersheds.
We have about 12 minutes left maybe in this part of Focus 580. Joining us here on the telephone, Patrice Charlebois. She's an aquatic invasive specialist with Illinois Indiana Sea Grant. And also here in the studio with me, John Epifanio. He works with the Illinois State Natural History Survey. He's a molecular ecologist with the survey, and they're based here on the U of I campus in Urbana-Champaign. He's also a research coordinator with Illinois Indiana Sea Grant. And we're talking some this morning about the Great Lakes, their health, and we've been talking specifically about the issue of invasive non-native species in the lakes and the problems they can create and what we're trying to do, what scientists and naturalists are trying to do to deal with the problem. And taking as a case study here the thing that's been in the news so much lately, the Asian carp. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we've got some other callers here. We'll go next to someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Seems like there's a lot of attention focused on keeping them out of the Great Lakes, but they have free run up the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. Are there efforts in those states trying to keep them or control them out of those watersheds?
As far as I know, there are not the same kinds of intense and sort of this kind of effort that we had in the Chicago waterway, in part just because of the enormity of the basin. The rote known approach, the fish toxicant approach that was used up in the Chicago waterway, would be, first of all, it would be cost prohibitive in a larger watershed. There are other kinds of things that they're trying to do, and it has tended to be more on the if at all possible, the prevention side. We're going to have some issues as they start providing fish passage around lock and dam complexes in the Mississippi associated with navigation, those navigation dams. Fish passage is going to be required, and so the question is, how do we, can we design these so that we don't actually facilitate movement of these species, whereas the native and desirable species do have free passage up and down? And so the short answer to I think to the caller's question is it hasn't been as extensive and it isn't monumental, and they're trying to, again, it's a kind of a head scratcher. What do we do now with these things? Right now it's there's been a lot focusing on monitoring the movements of these guys and prevention, because the folks out in the Columbia Basin, the folks down in other watersheds in the Gulf Coast are very worried about these guys making a leap into their watersheds and how do they prevent that from happening. So and the other part about the Asian carp is that this is the poster child we have at this moment in time. 20 years ago we had the zebra mussel was the poster child. 30 years before that it was sea lamprey, and the pattern has tended to keep repeating itself, and ultimately I think, and it's always a sort of an adage, it's, you know, pound of prevention worth, you know, an ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. And if we can prevent these things from getting in and establishing, we're going to save ourselves a lot of effort, a lot of money, and a lot of heartache and witnessing some changes to ecosystems that sometimes just can't really withstand some of these changes.
Well, I want to thank the caller. Let's go on to somebody up in the northern part of the state, Paw Paw, line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I actually have studied trout in the northern, up in the northwest. But it seems to me like you might be able to correct one problem, but you might be adding several others. Because I've talked to other people that have tried certain ideas with certain other kinds of invasive species, and it kind of backfires on them. My question would be, like, all this electrical stuff and all this poisons you're putting in the rivers and the streams, do we honestly know what the effects are going to be, not short term, but long term, on the rest of the other species, and how are they being affected?
Well, that's a good question. Let me I'll pass it back to Patrice Charlebois. What do you think?
Actually, I'm going to throw that one to
John. Oh, all right. Good. Throw it back to John.
Because of his expertise with fishes in terms of the rotenone and that, John.
Right. Well, I think the caller hits a very important point that the toxicant used here, and I hesitate to always use the word poison because it tends to have a negative connotation, at least for humans. This stuff really doesn't affect humans per se. It really hits gill-breathing organisms primarily. But it's not specific to these Asian carp, to various other minnows. So anything in its path can, in fact, get hit. So in the case here that the state and the federal folks did on this last project was to go in ahead of time and try to remove and collect as many desirable fish and relocate them before they went in with the therapeutic effort there. We have a variety of chemicals that are all approved in the Great Lakes. We also have lampricides and that hit the adults and also hit the larvae stages of these things. And as these things become as our need becomes more acute, so does the intensification of our efforts at really understanding and identifying some more specific kinds of chemicals. We have a tough time doing it. There's nothing unique that we know about to target just the Asian carp. So when we use these kinds of approaches, it does. It can hit other minnow species, sport fish species, even commercially viable ones, and ones that have no commercial or recreational value, but simply have biodiversity value. So we have to be very thoughtful about when we go in there, because it's a very broad approach. So a lot of effort's going to be expended in the future for trying to identify some of these things, but I don't think we're there yet. And these conversations are occurring, and the managers are very mindful of all of these concerns.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We just have about 5-6 minutes left and some others, and we'll go next to someone in Gibson City, line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm calling. I've got two quick questions. One is related to the zebra mussel. From what I understand, there's recent research to suggest that these organisms don't attach to copper nickel alloy coated platforms, and I think that's one of the biggest problems is that they cover everything when they get the opportunity to. And I wonder whether there's any merit to what I'm reading about that, whether that's a possible way to deal with or to manage the zebra mussel population. And the second question is related to that. Zebra mussels, from what I understand, and the quagga mussels provide a beneficial effect in the sense that they filter water about a quart a day each, and thereby making the water cleaner so that algae and whatnot can grow and support some other species. Is there any potential benefit to, say, a species like the Asian carp that is beneficial, maybe not outweigh the negative of them coming in and taking over the area from some other species food source, but is there any beneficial aspects of them coming into the new area?
Okay.
Pat, go ahead, please.
Zebra
mussels, you're right in that they do filter a lot of water per day, but what they're doing is they're making the water clearer, not necessarily cleaner. So they're removing the suspended particles from the water, but that's primarily food for other organisms. So it's a negative thing that they're doing. They're not making it cleaner, just clearer. And on the not attaching to the copper nickel alloy, I can't comment on that particular the alloy, but they boats can. Apply like the copper paints that they have, and that will keep the zebra mussels off. So in general, there are copper works as a deterrent to having zebra mussels attached to things. And so I hope that answers your question. In terms of what was the other part of his question? It was
the potential benefits. I think he was asking this question of if indeed the mussels have that filtering effect, and that the Asian carp, I think you talked in fact in the beginning about how they were originally brought in by people who were doing aquaculture for that function, that is to clean up algae that grew in their ponds. But again, that there can be, I guess, a downside, because what they're doing is if you have too many of them, that's the food supply for other fish.
Exactly.
So then that maybe gets to this question of, well, is there some might there be some kind of benefit if they have that kind of filtering function?
The only benefit I could see would be like in an aquaculture pond or in someone's backyard pond where, they could use the Asian carp to remove noxious amounts of algal blooms. But there are also chemicals there are lots of other ways that we can take care of problems like that. And so I would never recommend using Asian carp for doing something like that. And in terms of other benefits, boy, John, can you think of any?
Well, I mean, there may be some other kinds of benefits of which we're not really aware of right now, but I think we've witnessed what's happened in the community conversion in the Mississippi system, where the biomass is converted largely to these non-native species assemblages at the expense of, in most cases, the native assemblages. So there's a big risk to the local biological diversity. And we don't have really good economic numbers to stick on the values of these things. We often do it in terms of the value of a sport fish or the value of a commercial fishery or even a tourism value for having river days in a local community. It's very difficult to pin a number on those. So the big risk actually is when we lose those other components more so than what we gain by having this other new quote-unquote component in the community. Again, there's very few incidences of a free lunch in the ecological world.
Yeah. You know. We'll try real quick to get one more caller, and that would be Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have a general question. I'm very pleased to hear this program on the public radio. I want your interviewers to comment on how readily available are the funds coming from the state and federal coffers for general use by the Natural History Survey, as well as universities, to fund graduate research on emerging and existing environmental problems.
Well, we can do that, John.
Well, as like all things with the university right now with the economic downturn, the Natural History Survey and others are fully participating in that economic downturn. We do have a number of venues available. The state has, through taxpayers, provided some funding for these university elements through the Institute of Natural Resource and Sustainability. Sea Grant gets federal dollars, which we, and part of our program is to get money out the door, and it doesn't stay in Sea Grant. We solicit grant proposals and then fund those as well. The dollars tend to be outside sources. We are a pretty effective engine, I would argue, that in bringing in outside money. For every dollar we get from the state, from citizens like you, we generate four more. So we're a pretty effective engine at delivering the scientific enterprise. And a lot of that is done through graduate education and other sources here at the university, as well as a network of field stations and other programs in communities throughout the state of Illinois.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that point. I'm sure if anybody is interested in finding out more about the state Illinois State Natural History Survey, you can go to their website. There's one for the water survey. There's one for the geological. All the three major surveys, they're here on the campus. They all have websites. If you'd like to find out what they're doing, you can take a look at those. For now, we have to say thanks to our guest, John Epifanio. He is a molecular ecologist with the Illinois State Natural History Survey. Here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign, also research coordinator with Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And joining us by telephone is Patrice Charlebois. She's an aquatic invasive specialist with Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.